Of the House Committee on Human Services on May 22, 2009, I open up a work session on Senate Bill 313. Thank you, Senator, for coming again this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 313 is the bill that you heard, I believe it was last week or earlier this week, regarding the establishing a privilege of where a child communicates to a parent. There was a lot of confusion as to the structure of the original bill and what and how it would apply. And as it was originally written, it was extremely broad, and it would, in fact, provide a privilege that was much more, let's say, greater than what even I had anticipated and expected. And because of that, you have before you, I believe, three sets of amendments, 8, 9, and 10. I will tell you that there are actually are 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. All of those have a new definition or establishing what the privilege will be, which is Section 2 of the original bill on page 1, lines 5 through 9. When you look at the way the privilege would be under the any of these sets of amendments, it basically says that a parent may not be examined in a criminal action in which the child of the parent is a defendant. So in other words, the child has to be charged with an offense as a defendant, or the child is being processed through a juvenile proceeding. Further, the communication that is made to the parent is protected so long as certain the child is under 18 years of age, and that when that communication was made, it was out of the presence of any other person, with the exception of other children within that family. So that's the premise of what the privilege is. And the reason I want to make certain you understand that is because everything else works around that privilege. If you don't have what is required in the privilege, then you have no privilege. And that's where the confusion comes in, because when the drafting occurred, a lot of different, let's say, exceptions to the privilege were included in the amendments. And when you start reading them, it doesn't really make sense, because some of these deal with civil actions. It wouldn't apply, because this is only where there's a criminal action, with the understanding that the juvenile proceeding is considered civil. But and the way this is written, from my perspective, this is more of what we would consider a tort civil action as compared to the juvenile proceeding. So when you look at the three amendments that are before you, and I will ask you to look at the original bill.
Not the engross. Okay.
At the engross, I would suggest to you as follows, and this is going to be a policy decision that you, the committee, is going to need to make.
Can you give us as you go through it, the amendments, so we can track which one we're talking about?
Right. Okay. This is going to be for section, this would be A8, and I will also say that it's also applied for, included in A9.
Thank you.
So both of those have what I'm going to go over. First of all, by adopting the new privilege as to being limited to where the child is charged or is going through juvenile court as a defendant, then when you look at who gets to claim the privilege, all of that stays the same as on the A and gross. That means the child can claim it, the parent can claim it, or as it says in C and D, a guardian, conservator, or personal representative of that child. Now, D actually probably is not necessary, because it says of the deceased child, and so that's one that's going to come out, because the child wouldn't be charged with an offense if the child's no longer living. So then you get down to who has the right to waive the privilege, and that's in the A and gross version of the bill. And the waiver can occur by the parent, by the child disclosing with express consent, as well as the parent. So really, the purpose of the privilege, as I see it, it is to protect the parent from being compelled or forced to testify. But there's nothing that would keep the parent to say, son, daughter, I will be testifying because I think this is what needs to happen. So that would still be protected. So when you drop down on the A and Gross bill, starting on line 22 on page 1, is sub 4, and this talks about where the section, or excuse me, the privilege does not apply. The only one that I would be promoting to this committee that should stay in is what is the sub F, which is on page 2, starting on line 3. And there it says, a criminal action in which the child is charged, that would be what's already required to be even included in the privilege, with a crime or the act of delinquency, and where the charge is resulting from a conduct of the child against the parent or a child in that marriage, in that family. So in other words, if Johnny did something to his sister or brother, then it wouldn't apply if it met the criteria as being criminal action or a juvenile proceeding, or if the child did something against the parent that he confided in, and of course that would be there. The other ones to me just do not either meet with what the purpose of what the privilege would be, or based on the redrafting of the privilege, are no longer applicable. And I will tell you that Kevin Neely and I have talked on numerous occasions. He's going to present his perspective from ODAA as to why homicide should be included, as well as, I believe, child abuse on a more general sense. And I will leave you with this. This is a policy decision for y'all to make as to what you think out of this committee should come forward. As I mentioned to you during my original testimony, I believe that it's time for us as Oregonians to preserve a family, allow the child to be able to have confidential communications with the parent, with that one exception where the conduct is either against the parent that has been confided in or a child within that family. I will leave you with that. Currently, the child right now, the only places that he or she would find privilege would be through an attorney-client privilege, a social worker-client privilege, the clergy-penitent privilege, or a counselor-client privilege. So if you choose not to move this bill forward, you're basically saying to that family, for the parent, to the child, don't tell me anything. We need to get you to one of these other individuals so you can have counsel and you can have to deal with your emotional needs or your legal needs. And that's the presentation I want to give to the committee. And Madam Chair, if there's questions, I'll take them now. If not, then I need to go upstairs to start my other committee.
Right. So the dash 8 and 9s were your amendments? No.
8 would be the ones that we would be moving forward, but I will tell you that when you look at just the dash 8 on the amendment itself, on on page 1, line 13, that one does not make any sense, because there it says a criminal action in which the parent to whom the communication is made with the charge is committed against a person. So basically what you have there is the parent is charged. And the only way the privilege would actually work, remember, is the child is charged.
Right.
So if the child is charged and the parent's charged, you're not going to get the parent up there to testify anyway, because whoever represents the parent is going to say they're not testifying. He or she is a defendant. So that's why A doesn't need to be there.
And 9 does the same thing, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
The parent is charged. Okay.
And that's why we kind of got this, muddied set of amendments that kind of dealt with what the original bill provided for as a privilege, which is no longer would be the privilege under either 8 or 9.
Okay.
And then lastly, you have on 8, you have on line 20, the C, which says any criminal action involving child abuse or neglect by an adult. And again, what we're talking about is the child being
right.
charged, not
okay.
some adult.
All right. So help us understand, 10, is 10 your amendment?
No, this is the one that Kevin will be bringing forward. And what it basically does, from my review, is it keeps pretty much everything in the A and Gross 4. Remember, this is sub 4, A through G. And then it picks up a new H, which is the homicide exception. as well as keeping the obese one, which now is renumbered as I. And I'll tell you, Madam Chair and committee members, I spent about a good hour going through all of these to try to connect all the dots. So I know it's very confusing because I work in this area for 20-plus years, and all of a sudden you start trying to see how this all intertwined. And I think what happened is that there was a desire by some of the members to maintain some of the stuff that was in there, but didn't realize that once you changed what and narrowed the privilege to criminal actions involving or against the child or adjudications in juvenile court against the child, you really didn't need to have all this stuff within the waiver section.
Representative Cowan.
Just, I'm struggling to understand the amendments. So are any of the amendments yours?
Well, the best one I could say would come closest would be 8. But there are two parts in that 8, the line 13, sub A under 4, and the sub C. Now, Madam Chair and Representative Cowan, there was a discussion with the Chair as well as with the three of us that it may be best for you to take the testimony today, figure out what the committee wants to do, get a new set of amendments, and then you would have whatever is this committee wants to be passed out on Wednesday, I believe, would be your next meeting.
Right. Understood. I just wanted to understand which ones were closest.
Yeah. So what does 8 do that you would support? I understand what you're saying. If the parent commits the crimes, and that is not an issue that we're wanting to protect.
I think as a public policy, Madam Chair, the B that's in 8, and it's also the one that's also in 9, would extend the public policy that if the child who has confessed, who is now charged with the crime, has done an act against the parent who they have confided in, or if they have done something within the immediate family to a sibling, that shouldn't be protected.
That should not.
Should not be protected.
Okay.
I do believe that's a good public policy. Remember, under all of these circumstances, the parent has the right to waive. And can't the privilege basically says that they couldn't be compelled, but they have the right to break that if they choose to do so individually, voluntarily.
Okay. Any other? Oh, Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Floyd, last time, and I can't remember if you'd already left or not, but we had some testimony about how foster children might be affected. And did you happen to hear that?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I did not. When you look at the definition of a parent, I believe it does in fact include, let's say, more than what you would call the traditional family. And so the step family scenario.
Step, yes. Foster parent, no.
Oh, foster.
Foster parent, no.
Mm-hmm. Foster parent, no.
That's correct. And I can't remember who testified about that, but somebody did.
Okay.
Not the foster. So they're still not taking.
Well, that's something, Madam Chair and Representative Boone, if you wanted to, since you're going to have an amendment come back, you could add that into that to cover that area if that's what the committee wants.
Well, I was just wondering because in the case, follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Boone.
In the case, say that was a foster child who committed a crime, and that foster parent is not the real parent or biological parent, and the biological parent of the foster child is either dead or not able to be there for them, or is incarcerated or whatever, you know, the reason is not available. Then where does that child? Who does that child get to talk to?
And Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I think that's a point that you would want to look at. And what I don't know is that on the A and Gross Bill on line 13, it's a sub C under 2, talks about the privilege created here, who can claim it. It says a guardian or a conservatory of the child. And so whether or not a foster parent would be considered a guardian sounds like probably not by legal terms. And so you may need to put that in there if that's what the committee wants to do.
Thank you.
Representative Van Norman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Well, is not the foster child, in fact, still a ward of the court? So that the court is, in essence, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
I should have gone to law
Okay, any other quick questions?
That's a good question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, so could you explain why exactly you think that the situation in which the parent is, you know, the object of the crime, why that should not be protected?
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, I believe the state has a duty for protection for public safety, and that these type of situations and scenarios, such as, and if you look at the husband-wife privilege, there is an exception there, too, for abuse. And this is the type of scenario that that child, we have clearly studies that if you don't address that type of conduct, can, in fact, manifest into other problems in the future. And so I believe public policy that we have established in other parts of confidential privileges should be extended in the same type of scenarios that if we establish this privilege, and that if the child has violated the parent or a sibling, that that shouldn't be just a family matter, mm-hmm. that it should, in fact, be something beyond that for public policy.
Right. But just follow up. Thank you. And I understand that if it's a crime against the person of the parent, but a crime against the property of the parent, you know, that seems to be a different order of you know, need to protect.
Right. And that's, again, I think that's a policy issue for this committee to look at. And if you would like to have something like that structured, I mean, I would agree with you when you look at the scale of wrong, harm, and potential problems in the future, acting out in a physical way against another individual is much greater than property itself. But I guess you could also have the argument made, depending on what that property, if it was, let's say, arson, that in itself could show and demonstrate a concern that public policy-wise, you may say, we want to be able to address that, because if that type of conduct is carried out against the property of the parent, couldn't it also be assumed that it may occur against someone in the greater society?
Any other quick questions before the senator has to return to his committee? Right. Thank you so much,
Senator.
Thank
you all very much for having me.
Okay, we're going to move on. Kevin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. As Senator Prozanski said, we've been talking a lot about this bill, and I wish that I could tell you that we were here holding hands together on this bill. Unfortunately, we're not. We're about 96% holding hands on this bill, but we're about one pinky short here. And so I'll lay out where I think the decision for the committee is, and the reasons why we want to go in a slightly different direction than where the senator would like to go. So, again, I think Senator Prozanski did a great job of boiling down a complicated bill. Bottom line here, this bill will protect confidential communication. So when a child talks to a parent with an expectation of confidentiality, nobody else there except potentially other kids in the household, can we use that communication that went to the parent without can we use that communication in court? Can we compel the parent to come in and testify? That's the question. And what Senator Prozanski says is only in those instances in which there's basically a crime that's been committed inside the family. So as Representative Dimbrough noted, there's a property offense that's been committed inside the family, or if there's some sort of violent victimization that's occurred inside the family. That's the exception that would be in the bill were we to adopt the Senator Prozanski's model. Again, I'm boiling it down in its most simple state. And hopefully Maura mostly agrees with that. I think that's – you always hate to describe somebody else's ideas. But what we would like to do, I'd say that starting from the premise that the district attorneys are uncomfortable with any privilege because, as we said earlier last week, almost all of these privileges at some point will result in us being unable to prosecute a crime. So the balance. Are we willing to not prosecute crimes and make victims whole in exchange for protecting the family? And the answer the association has come to is there are instances in which that is probably a sensible compromise. Drug cases, we want these children to be able to confide in their parents about certain types of activity that the family unit hopefully can address and resolve. That's a reasonable request. And you heard from Juvenile Rights Project and from OCDLA last week that the problem with the state of the law right now is there are thousands of kids that are charged with crimes that are being served by attorneys in the course of a criminal proceeding. And in each one of those instances, the attorney needs to say to the child, it would be best if you don't share information with your parent, or your parent may be compelled to testify against you. I get that's a pretty compelling argument for having this privilege. So we understand that. We listened to what they said, and we said, okay, how can we ameliorate the damage that we feel like will be done to criminal justice, but address the concerns they had about all these cases where they have to give that warning, even though, as we all agree, the instances in which we're going to use this ability to bring a parent who doesn't want to testify against his or her child into the courtroom are minuscule. So what we decided was we need to look at those cases where we have the most severe levels of victimization, and those cases where the victims often don't have the ability to speak for themselves. Cases where someone has died, cases where you have a child who has been abused. Again, in those cases, we have a situation where the victim may not be able to share their own thoughts on what's happened in the crime. And so we may be forced to rely on that worst possible evidence, which is compelling a parent to testify against their own kid. Why would we want to do that? Because these crimes are incredibly serious. Someone has died. A child who may not be able to speak for themselves has been abused. So what we would ask the committee to do is consider a carve-out for those very limited instances. So now when we go back to the scenario that was described to you last week, the scenario where there's thousands of cases where the child has to be counseled not to talk to their parent, we have carved down the number of cases where that counseling has to occur to what we believe is the barest minimum. Only those cases where the child has been accused of a criminal action in which someone has died or another child has been abused. Remember, already in this bill, there's a carve-out if that child has abused another child in the family. But as you heard Char Woods from Multnomah County say when she was here last week, there are many instances in which the abuse doesn't occur within the family unit, but just slightly outside of it. A nephew comes over, a niece comes over, and an 17-year-old, a 16-year-old victimizes that 3-4-year-old nephew or niece, and only admits that to mom or dad. So those are the types of cases we want to carve out. And again, we think it's a sensible exception. We think, as I said earlier, 90%+ of the cases we have, there's not that type of victimization, and parents are going to be able to freely speak, or kids are going to be able to freely speak to their parent about the criminal conduct, and we won't be able to bring any of that information in the courtroom unless the parent consents to do so. It seems like, to us, arrangement that we can all adopt and feel good about. We know that there's not going to be a murder that gets perpetrated where we aren't going to be able to get to the truth and get a criminal prosecution. Yet we also know that a young man who has a drug abuse problem or gets involved in a gang violence can go and talk to mom or dad about what's happening in their lives and get the help they need without the threat of mom coming in and testifying against them in a courtroom. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. And again, as I said, the policy that we would like the committee to adopt, we think, is 95% there. But that 5% that's remaining are the cases that make all of us shudder. And I'd ask you to think about, if you had someone in your own family, that was victimized, that was murdered, that was abused, I'm pretty sure you'd want the district attorney to be able to use every tool in their arsenal to make sure justice was served.
Thank you very much. I see that the Senate President has come, and I've given him a time certain. Maura, can you stick around for a while? And Kevin, can you?
Absolutely.
And we'll come back to this. So I'm going to be opening up a work session, public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 401.
Senate Bill 401 requires the Department of Human Services to develop and implement a plan to increase supervision and treatment options in underserved areas for individuals released under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. It requires the department to submit to the legislature the plan, an assessment of the department's progress, and a description of the financial or legal impediments to implementation.
Great. Mr. President, would you come and testify in front of us this morning? We're so delighted to have you and honored. Great tie. Good to have you, Sasha, also.
Thank you, Chair DeMay, and members of the House Human Services Committee, Mr. Dumbrow, Mr. Bauer, Mr. Collins. Representative Boone, Representative Hoffman, Representative Van Orman, Representative Freeman. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem and Jervis and Woodburn. Before you today is, I believe, Senate Bill 401, and it directs the Department of Human Services to create a plan to equalize the distribution of Psychiatric Security Review Board transitional housing facilities throughout the state. These facilities house individuals who are under the jurisdiction of what we call the PSRB, as you know, but who no longer need the security and support of the Oregon State Hospital. These are transitional houses that are in the state for individuals who have been in the what we call the state hospital. Maybe one day we'll use a different name. It's a new facility here in Salem. And then have been placed in these facilities. Currently, there is extraordinary difference between the number of facilities in various counties, and I don't know if this chart will be handed out to you. I cannot interpret that chart. That is why Sasha Pollack, my extraordinary assistant and policy advisor, is with me, because she can interpret it in ways that I cannot. But it apparently allows me to say what I just said to you. It better, or I'm in a lot of trouble, that there is an extraordinary difference between the number of these facilities in different parts of the state. Obviously, a lot of them are in my neighborhood. I won't deny that. Obviously, here, but it's not just here. It's in other places in the state as well. This piece of legislation would equalize this by directing DHS to develop and implement a plan which would increase the availability of conditional release placements in underserved portions of the state of Oregon. The bill has been drafted to, number one, from a patient standpoint, because these placements are considered consolidated. Placements are consolidated. They are often far away from their support network, which can be harmful to their recovery. And number two, from a city standpoint, concentration of these facilities can overburden certain cities and counties with too many facilities for limited resources, while at the same time not allowing other communities the employment and economic development opportunities these centers can provide. This piece of legislation, we hope, would resolve these issues. I think this is the first step towards equalization not only of additional lease housing, but all types of mental health facilities available in all communities throughout the state. This full continuum of care is important for all Oregonians who find themselves in need of mental health care no matter where they live. So, it's a straightforward piece of legislation directing human resources to take a look at the disproportionate number of the facilities located in different parts of the state and try to develop a plan so they're more equally distributed, but according to a number of criteria. So that's the bill. It came out of the light committee over in the House. Excuse me, the Senate, came off the Senate floor. I think it wasn't controversial at all. It hasn't been controversial up to now. And so it's before you, and I'm very grateful, Chair DeMay, that you'd be willing to even hear the bill, and also grateful that you'd be willing to allow me even to speak on it. So I do appreciate and thank you very much for that.
We're delighted to have you. Mr. President. Any questions of Senator Courtney? Representative Maurer, you look
thanks, Madam Chair. So, Senator Courtney, are you asking for it to be controversial? I'm trying to avoid the controversy.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I'm asking for the House to do what it usually does. And I'll just leave it there. I'm not asking for the House to be like the Senate. I'm asking for the House to be like the House. So I think that's the best way. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but that's the best way I think I can answer that question, Representative Maurer.
Any further questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. And, Senator, I just want you to know you're my hero. Here we go again.
Oh, yeah.
It's an old story. The far right column, and I just want to make sure I understand it. So the first number, we'll just take Clatsop, for example. Nobody from Clatsop is living in Clatsop, but 17 from Clatsop were sent to the hospital. Am I reading that right?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. I can give you a little bit of an overview and then a specific chart.
Okay.
Do we want to ask other questions and
other
I can come back to
questions
that?
Questions for Senator Courtney, who's did a great job.
Any questions of Senator Courtney?
Are you asking me to leave?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
I think we have no questions, Senator, but we'd love to have you stay.
But
please
you're going to
do.
Say something to him?
I am. Yeah.
Okay, I want to hear what you're going to say. Okay.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, the chart that you see in front of you is admittedly quite obtuse. It is it's a very dense, very well thought out chart, but it's kind of confusing. So I'm going to go through it. Down at the bottom in a box is kind of all you really need to know. The column on the far right is a ratio that compares the number of individuals who are on PSRB conditional release living in each county to the number of individuals that enter the PSRB system from each county. So they may not be the same individuals, but it's a ratio between how many folks from, for example, Clatsop or Coos County are currently in the system under the PSRB, and how many people, maybe not the same people, but how many individuals are living in that county. Ideally, that ratio would be about 1. As you can see from this chart, it ranges from 0 to up to 2.58 in Malheur County, Marion County 1.69. That means there's a dramatically larger number of folks living in the county than are coming from the county to be under the PSRB.
Follow up. So that I think I'm getting this. So take Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
8.28. What does that mean?
Right. That's a very large number. So if we go through these numbers as we go across the chart, Columbia County, the total number of residents, Columbia County residents who are currently under the PSRB is 5. The number that are at the state hospital, going over to the next column, is 1. The number of residents on conditional release is 3, and then the number of any individuals from any county who are living in Columbia County is 19. That's much larger than the number 5, which is in the original column. That was how many Columbia kind of sends out into the system.
So they have way more than
way
more. Share.
Mm-hmm.
And final follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Does that mean that Columbia County has some sort of residential treatment facility that takes, say, 25 people?
Representative Boone, I'm sorry, it's early this morning. Yes, they have potentially multiple facilities.
Okay.
There also may be individuals living in that community that are on their own and may not be in a facility, but are still under the jurisdiction of the PSRB.
Thank you.
Any further questions? This is an issue of fairness, I'd point out. It's too bad that Representative Olson isn't here because he and I have been working on this issue for about a year and a half. And one of the complaints that we have heard through working through this issue is that some communities have more than their share of people from the PSRB, and so we need to make sure that it's distributed in a much more fair basis throughout the state.
And
am I correct in that statement?
Absolutely. Chair Tomei, can I add just a couple
yes,
of other things
of course.
On the record? First of all, I want to make it clear that this does not direct the placement of any new houses. This just directs the department, when they are in the process of looking for new housing, to look at the kind of equalization throughout the state as a one of the, you know, as a part of the decision to put in a new house. This will not direct any new houses to be built because of this bill. I want to make sure that's clear.
With the new amendment that you will be coming back, or some the department will be coming back to the legislature, and I would they would be coming back to this committee to let us know how that process is going.
Yes, and the other statement I wanted to make was there are a lot of things to be gained from having these facilities in your community. In light of the economic times, these are solid jobs that pay a good wage. Most of them are privately owned by local companies. They're not state-run. So this is definitely an economic opportunity that is important to spread out throughout the state as well.
That's right. Representative Boone, one last question.
One last question. Well, I kind of looked through here, and it kind of looks like some of the higher numbers are out in the rural areas. And just for your information, anybody listening out there, I have been told that Tillamook County would really like to have some of these. So.
Good. We have somebody here from the the office that will maybe listen to that and work with you in providing that.
Because
what? Chair,
yeah. There's a point I'd like to make. Initially, when I asked for this bill to be drafted, I wanted to mandate this. And legislative council jumped all over me, and Sasha's going to, and told me I can't do it constitutionally or as well as with, it would violate federal legislation, housing legislation, as I understand it. So that is, because, you know, years ago in 1989, before any of you were born, I was in the Oregon legislature, and we developed what we call the ship and back bill in terms of people at the Oregon State Penitentiary, because so many of them were staying in one area. And we were allowed to do that. That is, you were, at least for the first 6 months, you had to be sent back to the county from whence you were sentenced. And then while we had some exemptions and exceptions to that, we were allowed to do that. So I thought we could do the same thing here. And when housing got involved, our legislative council made it very clear to me with a legal opinion, Peter, you cannot do that in this legislation. That is in violation of federal law, and so you cannot do that. So that is why we're going out of our way to make sure, and Sasha just said it, this bill does not mandate, but it does develop, it asked him to develop a plan of equalization, et cetera. So if you're all interested, you may not be interested in that, but I ran into a lot of trouble with the mandate, thinking I'll just do what we did. It was Kevin Mannix that did it when he was a state representative, and it's called the Ship and Back Bill, and I joined him on it. We were getting so many state penitentiary individuals just coming out, staying right there a block away, and it was causing some issues. And so we developed that, and that was constitutionally sound. This one, you can't use the same approach for the extent you're even interested in that, Chair, to me.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Kellner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, Senator, the bill directs that the interim report will come to the Judiciary Committees in the House and Senate. We're hearing it here. I'm wondering why we won't hear it more.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, actually the A. N. Gross version of the bill has changed that. It that was the original intent, and it is now going to the Speaker and the President to be assigned to the appropriate committee. That was a change.
My apologies for pulling up the wrong page. Sorry about that.
But that was, Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, that was spotted earlier, and for some obvious reasons we realized we needed to amend the bill. So
my question must have been justified.
Yes.
It was.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you so much. Thank you for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you.
Jane Allen, we're going to take some quick testimony from you, and then we'd like to pass this bill.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'll be very quick. The Department of Human Services appreciates Senator Courtney bringing this bill forward. We fully support it and will continue to work to make sure that we have appropriate services throughout the state for individuals, including residential treatment facilities and the mental health services that those individuals need. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that I could, but I think Sasha did a great job, so thank you.
Any questions? All right, thank you very much. Okay. Representative Olson.
Court of work session. Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 401 A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 401 A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Dembra?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Cummings?
Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 401A passes and will be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and I will carry this bill. Okay. I know we're eventually going to get back to 313, but I'm going to go through some other things first. I'm opening up a work session on Senate Bill 734. Colleagues, there are some amendments that are still being worked on, and so we're not going to be having a lot of time to work in this session, in this committee, so I'm going to be sending this off to rules. So, Representative Boone?
Madam Chair, what's that number? Oh, thank you. I move Senate Bill 734 to the Committee on Rules without recommendation as to passage.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 734 to the Committee on Rules without recommendation as to passage. Any discussion?
Representative Maurer? Madam Chair, I would have much preferred to work this bill in this committee.
I know, and I can really appreciate it, and I know you've worked hard on this, too, and as has Senator Morissette, and I think it bears some time to take an interest in this, and so I'd like to send it to rules, see what we can do with it there. Any further discussion? Keith, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Cummings?
Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 734 will go to the Committee on Rules without recommendation. Okay. And I still want to get back to 313, but we're going to go through some quick ones that we've already had work sessions on, and public hearings on. So I'm going to open up a did I close the work session on 734? Do so done. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 875.
This bill, as we heard earlier this week, prohibits the charging of fees or deposits for assistance animals in rented housing and brings state statute into compliance with federal statute to allow Bureau of Labor and Industries to continue to investigate head cases.
Colleagues, I had brought up the issue about whether or not animals are service animals. I had a long meeting with Bob Esterbrook from Boley. He came in briefly this morning, right before the meeting. He's having a vacation today, or else he would have come in to testify, and we can reach him by phone, but I didn't think it was necessary. I was satisfied that issue was settled. So are we ready to vote on that?
Did you get your movie right in there?
So, Madam Chair, he's basically kind of taking a vacation day?
Yes.
I'd like to disrupt him. I mean,
if it's a furlough day, you're not allowed.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 875 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 875 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Huffman.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Did Representative Boone's monkey, service monkey, it's taken care of?
Oh, yeah, it's taken care of.
Okay.
I was just going to make sure. We're on the same track here. Thank you,
Doing
Madam
business.
Chair.
I'm going to borrow it.
I got
leave. Well, Madam Chair, the monkey still has to get through the Environment and Water Committee, too. So.
Oh, okay. I'll wait. My dishes will pile up.
Representative Dimbo. I'd just like to comment that I've spoken with Mr. Esterbrook about the Boley's requirement to enforce wage and hour laws with these service animals. And I think they're being underpaid at present, and we're looking into it.
Oh, I can't believe it. My college freshman over here.
You slipped that one in really well, didn't you?
I know it. I thought it was going to be serious. It's a busy day.
Madam Chair, in all seriousness, I hope you guys can take this seriously. This really is an issue, and we've been having fun with it and everything, but it's a serious issue. And when you think about somebody who cannot help themselves and has been able to train a little animal to do that, I mean, I was amazed. I'd never heard of
that. We all want one. That's
right. That's it.
That's what
okay.
We're saying.
Representative Boone.
Enough
I mean, sense. Olson. You.
We're interchangeable.
Who has it?
We gave it to you.
The motion is before us. We're just we've
yeah,
been in discussion.
Oh,
on
oh.
The
yeah, all right.
We're ready
you,
to vote.
Call the roll quickly.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. So having passed with the required majority, Senate Bill 875 passes and goes to the floor with the pass recommendation. Representative Boone, you want to carry this? Or maybe Representative Dembro.
I'd be happy to.
Whatever. I think I could get it down to rational, but.
Okay. Anybody bidding on this?
No.
Okay.
Who's carrying it?
Oh, let's let you carry it. That'll be fun. Okay.
Uh-oh.
So we're going to... Okay, we close the work session on Senate Bill 875. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 200.
This bill, we heard a couple of weeks ago, declares homelessness a detriment to individuals, families, and communities and establishes a state policy regarding homelessness, requiring the Department of Human Services and the Housing and Community Services Department to work together to encourage innovation and create a comprehensive and collaborative support system and housing resources required to end and prevent homelessness.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 200 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 200 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? We had a long discussion about this, do you remember, colleagues, on the 8th of May a couple of weeks ago. So we had a long discussion. We got a lot of supportive testimony. So any discussion? Seeing none, will you call the roll, please, Kevin?
Representative Van
Arnold. Oh, aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having passed with the required majority, Senate Bill 200 passes with a due pass recommendation.
Unless someone else really wants to.
Sure. Then shall we give the other bill to Dembro?
Representative Dembro.
The animal bill? Okay. She's going to want to carry this one.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 200.
Okay. Moving right along.
We're moving along. Where am I now? 220.
You have to keep them on a leash, though.
Okay. Thank you. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 220.
This bill authorizes the Attorney General to administer Federal Violence Against Women Act grants and any other state or federal grant related to service for victims of violent crimes, property crimes, and crimes involving fraud and deception.
Okay, and we had a hearing on this on, we've had a hearing on May 1st. There's no fiscal impact. Are we ready to vote on this, friends? All right.
Yes. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 220A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 220A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required majority of votes, Senate Bill 220 passes, and we'll go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Olson, you'd like to carry?
I would.
Great. Thank you. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 220A. Okay. Okay, now we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 275. We're doing well.
This allows individuals with a serious mental illness to apply for medical assistance between 90 and 120 days prior to their release from a public institution and to receive assistance upon release if found to be eligible. Okay. We heard this on May 8th.
Righty.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 275A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 275A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Do you remember this would allow folks who are leaving the criminal justice system to get to apply for medical assistance upon release?
Madam Chair,
yes.
It essentially codifies and prioritizes what is current practice because of the necessity of this.
Right. Thank you, Representative. Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll, please, Keith?
Representative Dan Harmon.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required majority of votes, Senate Bill 275 passes, and we'll go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Cowan, would you carry that on
sure.
the floor? Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 275A. Wow.
Public hearing marks this on 157. Or do you want to go back to 313? It should be really quick.
Okay. We're going to open up a public hearing work session on Senate Bill 157A.
This bill expands the authority of the Department of Human Services and Oregon Employment Department to require fingerprints for the purpose of criminal records checks for employees, contractors, subcontractors, vendors, or volunteers who have access to sensitive information or provide care to individuals. We have Patty O'Sullivan from the Department of Human Services. You should have in your packets or in your email a statement submitted earlier this week by Andrea from ACLU, who basically says that they worked on this on the Senate side and are neutral on the bill.
They had amendments on the Senate
yes.
side, that, and that's the A. N. Gross version that we have.
That's correct.
Hello, Patty.
Good morning, Representative. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. I'm bringing you Senate Bill 157 today, A. engrossed. It was pre-session filed by the department, and it was really a suggestion, started out as a suggestion from our AG to clarify some language in the statute that gives us the authority to do criminal background checks on employees and people that work with our clients and have access to any information about our clients, whether it's medical or addresses of children or whatever it is. Our current statute says that we can do background checks, and it had a term there says for agency employment purposes, and the clarification was to make sure that that included people that are our providers and our contractors and our volunteers, because we contract out so much of our work and we do have volunteers out in the field to help with driving kids back and forth and doing things like that, and they all have to have background checks, whether it's just a LEDS or a fingerprint. So it was started out as a clarification. Andrea contacted me and wasn't real comfortable with the language that would have supplanted that, which was still a little vague. It just said contractors, vendors, volunteers. She wanted it to be more specific to whatever they were actually doing in the department. So we went through a lot of lists of things that were in other bills this session and came up with this clarifying list of activities that would frankly cover just about everything in our department anyway, and we're comfortable with that and she's comfortable with that, so it's a good bill, and there was no opposition and there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you, Patty.
Sure.
Any questions of Mrs. Sullivan?
Thank
just real quick. You say there's no fiscal impact. Do you expect to be doing more background checks than you did before? Or?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, no. It's just a clarification.
Clarifications.
Yeah, we were already doing them. We already do background checks on anybody who has access to our clients because they're all vulnerable folks. And to any records about our clients, about where they might live, what medications they're taking, what their health status is, mental health status, A&D issues. That's all confidential under HIPAA and other regulations. And then, of course, we have, anybody that handles finances. And, I mean, there's all kinds of confidential information around a department like that. And so we need to know who has access to people, information, and money.
Any other questions of this witness? Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Representative Olson. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 157A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 157A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seems like a pretty cut and dried bill. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Pembroke?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Hudson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the majority of votes required for the passage of this bill, Senate Bill 157A passes with the required majority and will go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I think this can go on consent calendar. What do you think?
Yeah, so.
Okay. Consent calendar it is. Okay. We have only one more, right?
287, and then we can go back to 313, I think.
Okay. All right. So we will open up a
close the work session on
close the work session on what was it?
157.
Open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 287.
Senate Bill 287 permits the Department of Human Services to deny, suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew the license for residential training or treatment facilities, homes, or adult foster homes that are not or have not been in compliance with licensing requirements as established by rule. Mary Geer is on furlough today. You have her testimony. Mary Lee Fay is here from the Department of Human Services if you have questions.
Mary Lee, would you come up, please? Oh, and Bob Jundiff, come up, please. Hi, Mary Lee. Thanks
good
for
morning,
coming
Chair
today.
Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm the Administrator of Developmental Disabilities with Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. You have my written testimony in front of you, and we are here in support of this bill. It assists us in, as we have ever-growing providers who have services and support people in multiple parts of the state. There are times when their performance might be indicative of an agency issue, and this particular bill allows us to take action regarding their licenses for an entire program based on sometimes performances at a single site. It's permissive sometimes. Those performances are truly site-related, and we don't want to take entire actions against an agency based on that, but this does give us the ability to look at those scenarios and determine when they are really systematic and allows us to take appropriate action. So this is a bill we are in support of.
Thank you, Mary Lee.
Madam Chair?
Anybody have any questions for Mary Lee? We'll keep her here. So you'll have another chance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Jundiff from Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for an opportunity to talk to you today about Senate Bill 287. Very quickly, this is a bill that I view as just an efficiency matter. The state is charged with overseeing a variety of residential facilities across the state. When they find a serious problem in one facility, it only makes sense to look at the entire program just to assure the people are safe. We think this will help them do that, and that's why we think it's a good bill. It doesn't make major changes. It's pretty simple, and it's just designed to give the department the ability to work more efficiently.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions of either of these two? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. For me, it's very reminiscent, based on performance standards, if you're out of compliance in one center, let's say you've got multiple centers, if one center is out of compliance in a standard, the whole program is out of compliance, and that's kind of what we're saying here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman.
Any further questions or comments? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone here who else who wishes to speak on this bill? Seeing none.
Member Chair, ready for a motion?
Yes, I am.
I move Senate Bill 287A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 287A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, can we call the roll, please?
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 287A passes the committee with flying colors. And Representative Van Orman, will you carry this bill?
Thank you.
We'll send it forward with the due pass recommendation. Thank you. And with that, I'll close the public hearing and work session on 287A. And we've already opened the work session on 313. So come back up. Thanks for staying. We got a lot of work done while you waited for us. So, Maura, you haven't had a chance to speak yet, and then I'm sure we've got questions for both of you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Maura Roach, Juvenile Rights Project. Sort of taking off from where we left things with Kevin's testimony regarding the differences between the two versions that are before you, being homicide and child abuse. I wanted to speak to the child abuse issue. We've very well clarified in one of the exemptions that crimes that are committed within sort of the family, within the household, would be exempted from the privilege so that a parent could, in fact, be compelled to testify. But if we were to leave child abuse as an exemption without clarifying that it's child abuse committed by an adult, I think that that would be problematic, because child abuse is defined as an assault. And so in order to kind of pull in Kevin's scenario regarding perhaps the abuse of an extended family member that wouldn't fit into the exemption that Senator Prozomsky has put forward, we also scoop in any sort of, say, teen-on-teen altercation that would result in an assault 4 or a low-level assault charge, and we scoop in much more serious assaults, which could, in fact, result in charges against the child that are bringing the child before the adult court and resulting in a mandatory minimum sentence. And while those are very serious and we don't want to take those lightly, I also think the consequences for those can be, in fact, life-changing for children, and that is a time when the counsel of a parent navigating the legal proceedings and the parent and child being able to communicate with one another through that process are quite critical. And so so we have grave concerns about opening up the child abuse exemption as largely as Kevin has described, and we're comfortable with the exemption that protects things that compels or can compel the testimony of a parent within the confines of the family. I'll also remind you that a parent can waive the privilege. So if the niece or nephew or extended family member is abused and the parent is aware of it, the parent can choose to testify. It's within their ability to do this within the context of this bill.
Questions? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm really trying to understand this, and again, I've got two small children at home that would qualify under what we're talking about, and I'm trying to figure out how the balance of this works. We have charged our district attorneys with providing justice, and they're not supposed to be one side or the other. They're supposed to figure out what's right in things, and when we're talking about a possible tool that they use, taking that away from them. But then on the other side, we're talking about families and making sure that people get a chance to have strong families and work together within the family unit. Last time we heard this bill, we had testimony that a defense attorney said that she had handled thousands of child cases and only once had a parent compelled to testify. So I'm just trying to figure out what problem we're trying to solve and where that balance is. So maybe somebody could help me a little bit with that.
Sure. Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, that's a good point, and I think in our testimony both Kevin and I have acknowledged that. From our perspective, the problem is that the chilling effect for our attorneys when a child is charged with a crime and we're appointed as their attorney and the parent and the child come in, we say to the parent in every single case, you might be compelled to testify against your child. And because that exists as an opportunity, we are obliged to then say to them, so you're now going to sit in the hallway. We're going to take your kid into the lawyer's office, and we're going to meet. We're going to go through what's going to be happening here, and then we're going to counsel you, kid, do not talk to your parent about this. Then we're going to go back out in the hall, and we're going to remind the parent, do not talk to your kid about this. You could be compelled to testify against your child. So the chilling effect is in every single case, even though it's not that frequent that the DAs employ this.
Can I follow up real quick? So do you feel like that creates a less outcome of justice, or it creates a dividing of the family? I mean, what I'm trying to figure out, what I understand the challenges that might create, the difficulties for a parent and a child not to be able to talk, but back to the justice side, I'm trying to figure out, does it affect the quality of the justice that's served?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, I think many of our concerns do have to do with the ability of parents to parent their child through that process, and that comes in a lot of different ways, whether it's emotional and other forms of support, but also for the child not to be able to go back to the parent and sort of seek maybe even clarification about some of the conversations that have happened with the lawyer, I think maybe can sometimes affect the outcome of a case because a child may not understand everything that has occurred in that office or may come up with questions later that they'd like to talk with the parent about, and they're not going to be able to do that.
And one last thing, and then I'm sorry, I'm taking a bunch of time.
That's okay.
So how does that balance with what you believe is the job of justice being served? I mean, because it would seem to me as if the DAs would want the best outcome, too. I mean, maybe I'm... This isn't our normal course of discussion in this committee, so maybe I don't understand exactly what's supposed to happen with district attorneys, but it's my understanding they want the truth and the best outcome to happen. So I'm confused with wanting to make sure that, you know, parents do have that opportunity, but also in the very rare cases the DAs have used this ability to make people testify, it seems like those are only the most severe cases they use it. And I don't know why the issue is such a big deal with the other thousands of cases, I guess.
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, because the fact that parents can be compelled to testify under any circumstances, I'm not sure there's really any better way for me to say this, it creates the chilling effect that we have to counsel in every single case that family communication not happen. And so that is the task of this committee, is to weigh those two things. And I think, I don't want to speak for Kevin and he can jump in here, but, you know, that there's some acknowledgement, at least that in some cases, that's an appropriate balance to strike, that family communication be able to take place. I think where we're divided is where the line is that the family communication stop. We like the bright line of If the crime happens within the family, then the parent can be compelled to testify. We are comfortable with the fact that the parent can waive the privilege at any time and choose to testify in any case under any circumstances. And we would like to see the bill constructed that way because we think that that's an approach that makes sense. And the DAs would like to carve that bright line in a slightly different location, if I might put words in your mouth, Kevin. So,
for me, I'm thinking about this a lot, and I think of a 17-year-old who's been accused of a crime, and then, you know, that's one story. Then I think of an 8 or 9, 10-year-old who's been accused of a crime, who has been told that she can't speak with me. I'm thinking in particular now of my granddaughter, because my kids are all grown. She's a very withdrawn little girl. And so I tell her, so you can speak to the social worker, you can speak to a counselor, you can speak to the lawyer, but you can't talk with me about it. She's very withdrawn. She's not going to ever open up to anybody. And that's the child I feel protective of.
If I may.
Yeah.
I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I want her to be able to come and talk to me.
Yeah.
And let me help her through whatever she's doing. On the flip side, if she's on a date with a young man and he does something illegal to her and he tells his mom, I would want her to have to tell what happened. So, you know, that's my conflict. It's you know, if it's your child and you're wanting to protect him, it's great. If your child has been the victim and the, you know, the accused has told their parent, you may see that entirely different. So that's what I'm I'm back and forth on that. That's why I asked. And you know, I have a unique relationship with my district attorney, and I trust his judgment.
Yeah.
And that may not be the case everywhere. And I don't think he would wouldn't force somebody to do something unless it was absolutely necessary. And I trust his judgment. So, and I know this is a unique spot in time. We're talking about the whole state and forever. So
right.
I'm just trying to get my mind around it. So.
I know everybody wants to ask questions. Representative Boone, I think you
had
your hand up.
Yeah, I did. I had a couple questions before, so I guess I'll start with Kevin. And it was right about the time Senator Courtney came in, so going back a bit. Would the DAs approve of adding the other relative children, like the nieces and nephews and cousins that might be in the house, as well as a foster child, to that family mix?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I think that, again, any expansion makes us a little bit nervous. I think the spirit of the bill is that, as to the foster kid question, I'd have to go back and talk to my client, but I would be surprised if we're going to offer the privilege to parents of natural-born children or adopted children or children who are in the house who are under the guardianship of adult in the house, unless there's some other legal barrier that would prevent us, I don't think we'd have any concerns about that.
Is that your question, Representative?
Yeah, he's getting there, but I think he's going to say that. Go ahead and finish.
Okay.
It sounds like that the DAs would agree with adding foster children to that mix, because as the bill is written now.
Exempt.
Right.
Yes.
That I started with the second part of that question. I started with the second part of that question.
Okay.
The first part of that question is, would we be willing to narrow down the child abuse privilege carve out to family related, you know, relatives? And here's my answer to that. No, frankly, we wouldn't. And here's what I'd say in kind of defense of that. If you go back and look at the original bill and remember the testimony we had last week, the proponents of this bill at that point, at the point that we had this bill last week, it actually had a carve out for child abuse across the board, according to their testimony. And so what's happened now in the course of the amendment process is, and maybe that was a drafting error at the outset, but again, I believe they testified that in fact the bill did provide a carve out for child abuse. So I think that originally the bill had that, and we just want to keep it in the new version of the bill and add cases in which there's homicide. Now, I understand if that was a drafting error and originally, then it was a drafting error we could live with. But that being said, I think, again, the point of the child abuse carve-out isn't, it is because oftentimes the children that are victimized can't speak on their own behalf. And so we need to rely on other people to help us in protecting them. And in that instance, we may have to, in the needle in a haystack case, ask an unwilling parent to testify. That being said, I'm sensitive to what Mara said, which is that definition, child abuse, is the ocean. We, in our original assessment of the bill, we put together a list of crimes that are the ones we're really concerned about. We're not concerned about, I'm not going to say we're not concerned about an assault 4, because assault 4 is domestic violence. But we are concerned about, I mean, I don't think we want to scoop in all those random smaller abuses. The 17-year-old gets in a bar brawl. We may want to expand it, and if someone dies, we want to be able to resolve that issue. But I don't think, I think we would be comfortable with a actual definition. In fact, I know we'd be comfortable with a definition of what child abuse is, and I am more than happy to provide one to Juvenile Rights Project, to Senator Prozanski, and to the committee. We crafted one in our initial go-around on this bill. We never shared it with anybody, but we have bookends that we're happy to put on that. So that would be one possible narrowing, as opposed to just picking and choosing who the victims are, family, nephew, blah, 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 because you know you're going to miss someone there.
Well, let me just clarify that, just so I am comfortable with this. So I'll give you a scenario. Say there's a birthday party at the family, and the Aunt June brings her 3-year-old daughter, and the kid who lives in the house he's 16, 17, whatever. He takes her in the other room while everybody's having dinner, sexually abuses her, threatens her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so she's 3, so she can talk. But like you said, they don't often. What I'm getting at is if he does that and then say something happens and mom gets a call and says something's wrong with little something, did you do something to her? And he goes, well, yeah, sort of, yeah. And he tells his mom, because she's not a biological sister but she's a cousin, is that what you're saying? She doesn't get to be in that mix where she's that privilege doesn't count because he's assaulted a family member? I'm just looking at the A8, the line 16, a proceeding in which a child's charged with committing a crime, say he gets charged for it, or alleged to have act, whatever, against a person or property of the parent to whom the communication is made of, or another child of either parent. And I know that's not a child of either parent, but we're talking about adding a relative or a foster kid, that relative wouldn't be, that wouldn't count.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I do get what you're saying, and I may have, I thought as to the foster child, the question was, should we have an instance in which the privilege is extended to the foster child parent relationship? On that front, I think I'm comfortable. Said I don't want to talk too out of school without consulting with my client, but I'm pretty sure we're fine with that. As to the question at hand, I believe the answer is if there's a foster child who's in the home who is abused, I think they might fit in. I think we could probably get that abuse. That would be someone in the family. But the scenario you described was nephew comes over, is abused by, or I'm sorry, nephew comes over and abuses child. Nephew then goes back home and tells his mom. That clearly is not an instance.
No, the nephew lives with the mom.
I think it's the same.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
The answer is it has to be parent and child. No question. Right. Parent and child or sibling. So
the parent knows that the 17-year-old has abused a 3-year-old child. Right?
You're right.
So
right.
Is that protected?
That is not
confidential.
That is the so that communication is protected.
It is protected.
It is protected. The communication that wouldn't be protected is if the 17-year-old and the 13-year-old were half-brothers.
And I have to ask, and you did say that, thank you, but Mara, I have to say that child abuse is more than just assault for, and it's not just assault for, as Kevin said. It is a serious crime. Assault for can be beating the you-know-what out of somebody, and I just had to say that because I think that's serious. I guess then what I'm hearing you say is that if that happens, that scenario I gave, then that mom can say, oh, my God, my son just got accepted to Vanderbilt and on a full ride, and this would really wreck that, so I'm not saying anything. And that little girl then goes to her mom and finally says something, and that you cannot call the mom, and she knows. Is that, have I got that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, you've got it right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We've got several people who want to speak. Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
I had said that I was frustrated that this bill came before us, and I felt it should have been in judiciary. I'm not an attorney. I am a father of eight, and I understand that nothing about this bill is going to be perfect in every situation, but as I've gone back and forth and thought about this, and I understand that we may not have a lot of Leave It to Beaver homes anymore. We may, and some may, some may not. They're disjointed, they're dyslexic, they're every other dis. However, the more I think about this, I'm just going to tell you, not an attorney, as a father of eight, I have to uphold the rights of the family, and that's where I'm going to come down on this. There are going to be situations where it's not right, and maybe the mom needs to suck it up and do the right thing and be willing to testify against her 17-year-old son for doing something wrong, but I'm going to have to come down on the side of the family privilege and let that decision be up to the family unit, not the courts. So that's
thank
where
you,
I am.
Representative Callan, I think you have
I do, thank
questions.
You. A couple. Madam Chair, Mara, I'm listening to your testimony as well, and I think what I'm hearing you say is you don't support the exemption for homicide as well as child abuse, but rather feel that there's adequate exemptions built in for situations within the family or the parent's right to waive. So am I correct that you would not support an exemption in a case of homicide as well?
Madam Chair, Rep. Cowan, my organization actually doesn't have a position on that provision. I have heard Senator Prozonsky raise the concern with regard to the homicide provision that that privilege is not generally structured on existing until a particular charge occurs. And so I believe, not to speak for the senator, but that he's conveyed sort of a discomfort with taking the approach to that structure. And so I would just share that with you as a conversation I have had with him. As to the exemption that would exist around being able to compel testimony for crimes committed within the family, Juvenile Rights Project is comfortable with that, and we think that that creates an appropriate bright line that's easy to understand for our lawyers, easy to explain to our clients about where the line is, and so we prefer that construction to what the district attorneys have described under the child abuse provision as being the ocean, which we agree with.
Thank you.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for Kevin. In a conversation you had with me, one thing that you had mentioned that I didn't hear in today's testimony, and I can't say this word, so bear with me, but I believe I heard you say that even if a young person has admitted to a crime of homicide, that you have to have at least one other witness corroborate. See, I can't say that word.
Yeah, you
just
can.
That particular admission. And that was one of the reasons for wanting the exception for allowing a parent to do that is... Could you,
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, I can, and that is, in fact, that's the classic example of what happens in these cases. So you have a person, a juvenile, again, and I'd say right off the bat, when we're talking about homicide, we're almost always talking about individuals that are 15, 16, 17 years old that have killed somebody. We don't, there's not, I doubt you'd find a case where a district attorney in Oregon has prosecuted a young person for homicide that's really young. So maybe there's examples out there, but I think in general we don't handle those cases as adult homicides. There is the Arizona case.
There's a Clackamas County, Oregon City case.
10-year-old killed his sister.
Yeah. Again, there's probably exceptions to that rule, but by and large, you'll find that that's not the case. But bottom line, as to what Representative Cowan was talking about, individual admits that they have that they've committed the crime. They admit it to a officer of the law. We can't just take that admission into court and say, here, see, the kid admitted this. We have to have corroborating evidence for every confession. And so one of the ways, obviously, that we have to get that corroboration is we have to find someone else that has had that crime admitted to them. And very often in these cases, obviously, we turn to the parents. 99% of the time, they take the high road that Representative Huffman has talked about and want justice served. But in a very small number of cases, again, the district attorney is going to be compelled, and you all have to know, and I'm sure it's obvious, that the last option is bringing in an unwilling parent to testify, but there are going to be those rare cases where that needs to happen, and the best example is in the corroboration of some sort of admission of a crime. Again, it may be that that for whatever reason we can't find anybody else out there that individual admitted the crime to.
Final call. I guess just comments. I believe the intention of the chair is to sort of try to find a direction from the committee and then hopefully go back and craft an amendment that the committee can support. And from my perspective, I've weighed this a great deal, and I bring to it, like all the rest of you, the perspective of a parent and a grandparent. And I want to be able to communicate clearly and openly with my child or my grandchild, and I want them to feel that they can come to me. So I understand the driving force behind this, but I'm also looking at the force of justice involved. And if my granddaughter is that 3-year-old, and that Representative Boone described, I want justice for her as well. And so I really do support relatively narrow exemptions, but in the realm of both child abuse and homicide.
Okay. Representative
Bauer. Thanks, Madam Chair. There are many different kinds of privilege communications. Mm-hmm. And we were given a handout. You have clergy privilege. You have patient or a physician patient. You have stenographer, counselor, client, non-English interpreter. Those are all. I don't know if the right word. Unilateral privileges. Means that the physician or the counselor can't go out and speak arbitrarily, but in this case, the parent can, you know, say, come confide me, and then turn around and go testify in court. And there's, you know, that trust. To me, it doesn't seem, this is very different. This is a very different situation than any of those other. other than maybe husband-wife, mm-hmm. which is probably the closest. But there, the relationship is different because there's an impact. There are peers on par. Where here, you have the parent and the child, and the parent can have privileged conversation and then turn around without any threats or any retribution and go testify. So why, it just seems to me that this is, that we have an epiphany in the last year and say, oh, by golly, we need to have this privilege. If it was, I mean, that's the basic relationship in our world is between a child and a parent. How come it wasn't identified 1,000 years ago that this was part of a privileged communication, and that how come these nuances haven't been worked out? I question this as to why we're all of a sudden now just saying, oh, it's an issue and we need to address it.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I think that that's a very good question, and what I would tell the committee is you'll be the second state in the nation to do this, and that there's no doubt that this is a concept that is widely spread. You'll be the second state that ascribes a privilege to a parent based on communications between the parent and child. There are two states that ascribe a privilege to the child. Every other state doesn't recognize this privilege. It is something that is, that there are states that have considered it, but by and large, the bill that you're addressing, and I think the position that we're taking on this bill, there is a generous position because this is, there are virtually no states that allow parents this a special exception. That being said, I think that what's come out in many of these discussions is there is a unique relationship there, just like there's a unique relationship with the spousal privilege, just like there's a unique relationship with the psychotherapist and all those. But in almost every one of these privileges, and that's why we're in the place we're at, there are exceptions. In the spousal privilege, there's a range of exceptions. If you get divorced, guess what? You can go back and testify. There's a whole range of exceptions. Now, again, I think it's a two-part test for you guys, and you already know this. The first part is, do we really need a privilege? The second part is, if we do need the privilege, should there be bookends on it that protect victims? That would be what I'd tell you. Sorry, that's kind of a convoluted answer.
Yeah, sure.
Just a follow-up. There is an organization, and Representative Cowan sat on it with the tort for volunteers. What is the group?
Oregon Law Commission.
Oregon Law Commission. This is a legal question that you've got a bunch of amateurs, quite frankly, on this panel, with all due respect to our backgrounds, that I mean, this is a really very technical legal question, and I'm not at all comfortable that we have heard all of the nuanced arguments about what is appropriate and inappropriate for this privilege, and that's my grave concern. We're going to do something that is going to allow some punk to get away with a really horrific crime because of a technicality which most people, most normal citizens, would think is asinine.
I think most normal citizens think that they already have that privilege. If they've got a privilege with their spouse, I think they would assume that the parent-child relationship is much more intense than the spousal relationship. I think they would assume they already have that privilege.
I've got four kids.
I would be shocked that they didn't.
Okay, I've got four kids, and you know, I'm sorry, but we didn't have relationship, privileged communication class, after she got pregnant. It's like, I don't know. To me, you don't deal with it until it comes up, and then all of a sudden, then you find out what the law is.
Representative Van Orman and then Representative Boone.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. There are a lot of thoughts going through my mind, and I think before I ask my question, I would like to say that I'm sitting here thinking about the child. And I will grant you that a lot of these kids are in this position because they do have problems with their parents. But I do think that these children need the comfort and nurture during a very difficult time. Having said that, one of the things that comes up is we're talking about the role of the DA in the juvenile court process. And when I used to work there, a lot of that was between the court counselor, and a lot of that got taken to court by the court counselors as opposed to going through the DA. So it appears that it's transitioned to who now appears before the judge when a child has committed a crime. And because of that, it does change the relationship, and it does change the way juvenile crime is processed. And I guess the question I have is just how often does the DA get involved in juvenile court proceedings? All the time?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, that's a great question. And the answer is the district attorney gets involved in instances in which there's been a crime committed, in virtually every instance, if there's going to be an indictment. Now, an indictment isn't really the right thing, because we handle juvenile law in Oregon. It's a delinquency proceeding. And so we find that the individual has some sort of delinquency, and we then treat them at the youth facilities that we have around the state, except in rare instances. Well, not totally rare instances, but except in instances where you have serious violent victimization. Mm-hmm. Then in those instances, we waive children into the adult courts in some instances. Oh. Now, we only waive children into adult court in the worst of the worst cases, as you can imagine. And even if we do waive a child into adult court, the sentence that comes down, unless it's, you know, I hate to bring out the cases that everybody's heard about, but everybody's heard about, like, the Kip Kinkle case. In that case, the child would have been waived into adult court and could have gotten a very long sentence. Now, that case settled. But in most cases, the sentence that gets handed down to the individual child keeps them in a youth facility up until they're 25 years old. And then at that point, they're generally released. Only really in homicides and serious sex cases do we ever adjudicate a juvenile in a way that will get them into the adult prison system. And so I don't know if that answers your question. Bottom line is, the vast majority, 90%+ of the cases, juvenile cases, are handled by juvenile departments. And the outcome of those cases is time at McLaren or another juvenile type OYA facility.
Representative Olson.
I think Representative Boone, did you have something for her?
She does, but she's already spoken, so I'm giving
you. I just got to share, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm struggling with this bill. It's difficult for me to understand and know over the years, having worked in criminal investigations, understanding all the different scenarios and relationships involving privileged communication. And now all of a sudden you have a specific one that has a carve-out where a parent may choose to testify if they choose to, you know, given the situation. Now, getting back to what Representative Boone said, and then also Representative Huffman, his position on this bill right now, from how I gather, there's been a few times, I mean, a lot, where I've investigated sex abuse cases involving exactly the scenario that you described, Representative Boone. It is difficult to be the investigator with this scenario to all of a sudden try to go with this little three-year-old and their parents and her parents and to go over to the suspect's side of the family and say, well, there's nothing I can do because this is closed over here. How do you go back then to the victim and share that? It just doesn't work. And that's why I honestly believe, going with what Representative Maurer was trying to get to, the infinite wisdom that you've not seen the legislature ever do this in this state, create this type of a relationship, because they've understood this.
Then I guess if you follow that line of reasoning, then if it were the husband who had committed the crime, then the wife would not, and he told her, then she would not be required to testify against him.
Unfortunately, that would be correct in that type of a scenario.
Okay, Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I think some of my problem is I'm confused about all these amendments and who's or what, and who likes what in what.
So, and I think what my intent would be to draw up new amendments according to
right.
what the committee is liking, so it's going to be very clear. So I guess what I want to hear from committees, carve-outs do you want?
Okay. But I also wanted to find out, and I understand that.
Okay.
What, Kevin, you said that your organization has some sideboards, but you haven't come forward with them yet. So is that something we get to know about?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, again, when we looked at the bill originally, I think I work for a whole bunch of lawyers, 450 of them. It's a real treat. And 36 of them independently elected, I might add. But that being said, we always prefer clarity over any confusion at all, because I think it's safe to say that everything gets litigated, especially in criminal law. And so we will be more than happy to give the committee a list of crimes that are of most interest to us as it relates to that child abuse. And we'll also provide those to Juvenile Rights Project and to the senator, as I said earlier. I'll do that by the end of the day. I probably have them in my bag right now, but not going to make that absolute guarantee. But again, there can be sideboards that get put on that that I think address the most serious crimes.
Because I'd like to see is that, and then boiling these amendments down to whatever, because it's too bad that Senator Prozanski is not here, but because I had a couple questions for him, too, and because I've got Floyd, I think, mentioned these two pieces of this, but then these are the same, but there's an addition. But I heard him say the word homicide, and it's not in the ones that he said he liked of these amendments. So anyway, I think that's a great idea to have that information go to Juvenile Rights and to Senator Prozanski and vet it with them and see where we are at that point, plus our input.
We don't have a lot of time, of course.
I know.
Monday is a holiday.
I understand.
So I'm hoping to get some amendments in today and have them worked on so that we'll have them to look at on, hopefully, Tuesday. Maybe that's...
Yeah.
But anyway, certainly Wednesday morning. Yeah. And,
Wednesday our last day for committees? People
yes.
Like that.
Yes.
No, I know it's time certain.
Right.
I know that.
Yeah. So there was a hand over here. Representative Freeman.
You'd kind of asked where our positions were, and we were asked earlier a two-part question. The two-part question had to do with, is there a need for this at all, and if so, what? My answer to the first part would be, I have yet to understand the need for it, kind of like Ron and some other people said. But if we're going to do it, on the second part, I'd be very comfortable with supporting what the district attorneys who we charge with dispensing justice are comfortable with, because I don't want to take any tools away from them.
Okay. That was it.
Yes, Madam Chair, just quickly.
Denver.
Yes, I think I'm sympathetic to the notion of the privilege, and I have experienced situations in which parents were not aware that they did not have a privilege and were shocked to find out that they didn't, and it was very difficult. So I am sympathetic to it, but, I am also sympathetic to the notion of some carve-outs or sideboards, and I'd be interested to see what those might look like. I think that the idea of including property crimes as being exempt from the privilege, I'm not comfortable with that. I think what we're talking about are serious crimes against persons, particularly the most vulnerable. So I think that's where I am right now.
Okay. Any other?
Do you want us to do that now, or is that?
Well, if they'd like to say that now, I can.
That would be great.
Work with. So it sounds like at least, Representative Boone, you're interested in adding a foster child.
Just because of that testimony we heard, it sounded like that was not an afterthought, but, you know, that person, because they're not biological, they're kind of in a parental situation, so they should be. That's the parent they have.
And
you know?
Does it make sense? My thought is, rather than everything under one amendment, I would like to have several separate amendments so that we can say, I like this one, but I don't like that one, et cetera. So foster, I'd like that to be a separate amendment.
And I also agree with what Representative Dembro said. The serious crimes like, you know, murder, crimes
person
on persons.
Crimes.
Person crimes, is that what you call them? Yeah.
Homicide, we have that in A10-10.
Madam Chair, the
yes.
only issue I have with property crimes is the arson is a great example. You burn the house down, and the perpetrator thinks the family or that somebody's in it, and they're not. If they're not in the house, it's a property crime. And if they were in the house, then it becomes a person crime.
Madam Chair, Kevin, what would you think if we threw in just identified Measure 11 crimes? Because that would capture the first-degree arson.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I would be comfortable with that. I shouldn't say that. I'd be comfortable with that. That being said, as you know, oftentimes the sex abuse cases that we're talking about here, especially when there's a juvenile involved, we tend to not like to go to Measure 11 with those juveniles. We tend to like to get them into OIA so they can get treatment, so we'll march those down to a sex abuse 3, as you know, and in those instances. So I like the idea of, I think that, and when we originally talked with folks, we had said we'd like to get those serious physical injury crimes out of the picture here. We got a lot of resistance from the sponsor of the bill, which is why we didn't come forward with that amendment. That's where we, of course, want as big a carve out as we can get here, to be completely honest with you. But I think that's a great suggestion. You really do catch 90% of the worst crimes.
Wait, Madam Chair, follow up. I think you'd probably get all 36 of your DAs probably on board with that then, too.
Absolutely.
Instead of
I might have some trouble with that. We'll have to look into that. Dash 8, was that your amendment?
My amendments are the Dash 9s and the Dash 10s. And
the
Dash 8s are Senator Przanski's. And just FYI, the Dash A9s really do a lot. They're probably going to be closer to what you'd ultimately get, depending on what crimes, if you wanted to exclude any crimes, because they do carve out a whole bunch of the extraneous language. They still need to carve out line 11 of the original egg and gross bill and line. There's a couple lines right there.
Say that about 11.
Line 11, the privilege created by this section may be claimed by the child. That is no longer the case. The child can't claim the privilege.
Got
which
it.
One?
Okay,
and that's made
it.
Clear by the
okay.
amendments.
That's made clear
by the amendments to lines 5 through
great.
9.
Okay.
On all of the amendments.
Great.
On line 12, the parent to whom the communication is made, obviously we need to keep that in there. That's the whole point of the bill, though the truth is you don't really need it in there because it's made clear between 5 and 9, but it doesn't
keep
hurt to have it in
okay.
there. Line 13, a guardian or conservator for the child or guardian or conservator for the parent, I think.
Would cover foster parents.
Well,
right?
We don't think it would.
No, because they're not guardians.
Doesn't think it's
yeah.
Okay.
They're wards
in
the court.
Okay.
Maura tells me that foster children brings a whole new realm of problems, and Representative Van Orman seems to think that, too.
Yeah.
So
okay, got it.
We won't go down the foster child path right now. But certainly you'd want to have C in there, and D is unnecessary because the kid has to be charged with a crime, and as Senator Przanski pointed out, DAs charge a lot of things, but not dead people generally.
Okay.
That's line 15 and 16 can go out of there. And then you need to keep line 17.
That again?
No idea.
You need to keep line 17. The privilege
okay.
can be created by this section may be waived by. Well, I don't know if you need those. We'd have to find out if you need 17 through 20. And since neither of us are attorneys, we'll have to go back to our respective attorneys. And then in the A9 amendments, you can see they carve out everything after line 22 down to line 29 because none of that is needed based on the fact that what's required here to even open the door to this privilege is the child has to be accused of a crime. And so you don't need any of those things because they're all civil. And so, again, I don't know. Probably check with some civil attorneys about this, but not the civil attorneys I usually work with. And then after that is the exceptions, and the exceptions you will need are the family exceptions that are in there that you can read. We all agree that those family exceptions are in there. They're in virtually every privilege that's on the book that has to do with the family unit. And then after that, you have to decide how far down the exception list you want to go if you even want to do this to begin with. So I think that's a quick and dirty for Keeley about what needs to happen to this bill, and we can work with David on it.
Do you have anything?
Everything works for me till you get down to the down and dirty.
Page 2, controversial.
Okay, I think there are some people in the committee who see no need for this, so that's fine. You can vote your conscience however you want. There are some people who are supportive of the bill, would like to see some changes. There's some people, I think, Representative Huffman, you would like to protect the parent-child relationship as much as possible. Am I correct in that? So if there are some people who would like to see some changes that would make it possible for them to vote on this, could we meet, say, at 1 o'clock in my office, maybe with these two and with Keeley?
I can't because I'm on that special transportation committee.
Okay. Is there anybody else who's interested in seeing some changes that would make it more
Madam Chair, I would be interested in the sideboard with Measure 11 crimes. I mean, to use that as a measurement.
I would have a lot of trouble with that.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to look at sideboards, but probably not all of Measure 11.
Madam Chair, I'm not overly supportive of the concept in the first place, but I'm willing to look at it with sideboards. So if you can come up with what are considered adequate sideboards, I could think about it.
So can you meet with us at 1?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out right now because I had to turn my machine back on.
Is anybody else who's interested in meeting?
Well, so. I appreciate the invitation, but my concern is the waters are so muddy now that more people involved, I think, will just make it worse. So
okay. What I'm trying to do is get people to the point where you can support the legislation. So.
I'm still, you know, I need these people to work it out because I do support parent and child.
Okay. So, Representative Cowan?
Well, Madam Chair, while she's doing it, it's not that I don't support parent and child. The problem is that this is a very large and a very profound change in the privilege law that I think, quite frankly, needs more input with people that have a lot of experience than us. And try to take it out of the political for a little while and try to come up with a rationale. Because, I mean, the privilege, quite frankly, to me, makes sense at some level. But there are so many exceptions that we all accept.
And Madam Chair?
I'm waiting for Representative Cowan to look at her calendar.
I have a couple of fairly short appointments. I could come down to probably closer to 1:30.
1:30 is okay with me? Is it okay?
Well, why don't you get started and then I'll call you. Well, I do have committee that afternoon, so I'll have a limited amount of time.
Okay, that's fine. Representative Huffman?
Representative Maurer pretty much summed up what I was saying. I support some of that, but like I said, I don't feel qualified. I think it's the wrong committee, and I don't feel qualified. I'm not comfortable with it. I support the family.
Oh, I misunderstood.
I support the family privilege. I just am not sure that I'm qualified to really make that decision. I
misunderstood you in the same way the chair does, because with the comment about support of the family privilege, that does not exist now.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So, no, I understand it doesn't. You have concerns about the bill no matter what happens. Is that what you're saying?
I am. I mean, if I'm going to be forced to do something, I'm going to support family privilege and keep the family intact. I would rather not make that decision because I don't think I'm qualified. And I don't think it's appropriate for, I mean, honestly. I just,
this is our job, colleagues. That's what we've been scheduled to do. So I can appreciate that.
It can be our job to vote no.
You're basically saying what I said.
You can certainly vote no. That's your privilege. But it is our job to make legislation. That's what we're here to do, and that's what I'm hoping to do with this legislation. 1:30?
Maybe.
1:30? 1:30 is it. So if anybody, we can't have a forum, so we can't have five people.
I'll let you know. How about if I, is it your office?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, the only way I'm going to get there is if the DAs get there. So I think I made that clear. So if the DAs can make the meeting and they can figure something out, I'm sorry that I have to kind of, without being an expert, I've got to rely on somebody. And that, in my circle, that's who I'm going to rely on.
Got it.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Feeling?
You need to be sure that you carry this over until Wednesday, or we won't do anything at all.
Yeah, thank
carry
you.
The work session over to Wednesday.
Keely.
The work session on what the hell are we talking about?
3:13,
and we'll carry it over until next Wednesday. Thank you all very much. Good work today.
How many bills are we going to have Wednesday?
Yeah, 70.